Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, June 29th, and I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page this morning, the headline, Clearing the Way for Better Time Check Link. This story is by James Q. Lynch. Work to connect Cedar Rapids' Northwest Time Check neighborhood to Interstate 380 downtown and the rest of the city is moving a step ahead, as buildings in the path of the Ellis Boulevard extension are coming down. A former Mid-American Energy Service hub sitting on 3.3 acres at the intersection of Ellis and E Avenue Northwest is being raised as part of the plan to connect the northwest side and hopefully spur development in Time Check. After the city bought the site for $1.8 million, Mid-American moved its service center to 1035 76th Avenue Southwest. The city expects the property to be cleared by the end of July. Schrader Excavating and Grading has a nearly $114,000 contract for the demolition and cleanup of the Mid-American building, as well as a small city-owned building once used by its transit services. City officials believe the short extension of Ellis to 6th Street Northwest could have a transformative impact by easing traffic flow and improving access to the Northwest neighborhood, including a more direct link to I-380, downtown, and the rest of the city via 1st Avenue West. It also would enhance the city's complete streets connection for pedestrians and cyclists from north to south and could create developmental potential, according to the city. Plans for the two-year, $8 million project scheduled to start in 2022, call for reconfiguring E and F Avenues Northwest to simplify the design at the intersection where 1st Street Northwest, E Avenue Northwest, F Avenue Northwest, and the I-380 off-ramp come together. 6th Street Northwest will be extended to Ellis Boulevard Northwest, allowing for easier access. Connecting Edgewood Road to downtown via Ellis, part of a long-term vision plan adopted by the Northwest Neighbors Neighborhood Association, will put more energy into the neighborhood, Linda Seeger said on Monday. A member of the association's executive board, she has been vocal about flood recovery and mitigation in the area, as well as development plans. Seeger, who chose to stay in her home after the historic 2008 flood, believes the city's investment in the extension will also help get flood protection that would encourage development. It's been a long time coming, she said, adding that the Northwest neighborhood is the last neighborhood to recover from the flood. It will be a plus for the area. She's not as excited by plans by the city to build three traffic roundabouts on Ellis at O, F, and E Avenues. It would be nice if people could turn off 1st Avenue and drive down Ellis without getting too dizzy, Seeger said. Much of the Ellis corridor was devastated by the flood. The need for the extension had been discussed before the flood and after the Cedar River receded became a priority. City spokeswoman Emily Breen suggested that completing the connection could give rise to the sort of development seen in the Kingston Village, New Bohemia, and Czech Village neighborhoods. At one time, the Time Check neighborhood was populated with small grocery stores, restaurants, and shops. Although it still is recovering from the flood, some businesses have reopened and new housing has been developed over the last 11 years. More housing is planned along 8th Street Northwest. Matthew 25, a neighborhood development organization that has rehabilitated more than 100 homes, established Iowa's first urban farm in 2012, and grew a front yard program to provide garden beds and outdoor seating to encourage interaction among neighbors, has plans for a grocery store at E Avenue Northwest and Ellis, where it now operates a food pantry. A Matthew 25 spokesman said there are plans for a pizzeria and another restaurant. Funding sources for the project includes the city's Paving for Progress local option sales tax, tax increment funding, federal funding, and a state traffic safety grant for a roundabout at F Avenue. There will be an at-grade crossing at the Union Pacific Railroad tracks at a cost of $4 to $5 million, According to the city, a bridge over the tracks would be at least double that cost. And the front page includes a photo of the demolition equipment at that location and also a map of the boulevard extension. Also on the front page, this story by Vanessa Miller, UI picks 7 projects for $12 million from partnership. This story is from Iowa City. Near the end of the first full budget year since the University of Iowa initiated a $1.165 billion public-private partnership to operate its utility system, campus administrators have identified 7 projects to receive a total of $12 million from the partnership-enabled endowment. The approved projects, landing a range of $113,768 to $4 million over 2 to 3 years, focus on research endeavors, student success initiatives, and equity issues. Each of these projects not only will advance the university's strategic plan, but represents a collaborative effort unlike any we have ever seen at Iowa, said UI Provost Kevin Kregel, who co-chairs a strategy team that evaluated, vetted, and selected projects for funding. Each project spans multiple colleges and units, and each project's lead demonstrated a high level of dedication to ensuring their proposal would benefit as many parts of campus as possible. The total $12.13 million the UI is distributing from proceeds of its blockbuster public-private partnership, which it refers to as P3, is slightly below the $15 million officials said they expected to pull annually for campus-generated strategic initiatives when first announcing the deal in December 2019. The arrangement started with a $1.165 billion upfront payment from a collaborative involving Paris-based NG and investment firm Meridian. In exchange for that lump sum payment, the UI partner landed 50 years of secured income as the campus's utility system operator. The university agreed to pay the collaborative a $35 million annual fixed fee, plus the cost of utility expenses, employees, maintenance, upgrades, fuel, and other expenses. The fixed fee is slated to increase at an annual rate of 1.5%. The university expects to cover those costs out of a $985.9 million endowment it created with the upfront payment after paying off debts, consulting fees, and training. UI officials also touted expectations of pulling $15 million annually from the endowment for campus-generated strategic initiatives. In February, officials announced an initial $7.5 million would go toward initiatives similar to those unveiled this month, including efforts to develop new interdisciplinary research teams and deploying a faculty support, retention, and recruitment initiative. That initiative sought to enhance existing professional development programs and implement new ones in order to increase faculty retention and the recruitment of other talented faculty. After unveiling those first initiatives, the UI in February issued a second campus-wide call for letters of intent from faculty and staff wanting a cut of the upcoming first full year of P3 funding. The UI strategy team received 45 letters and picked 10 projects to submit full proposals, according to the UI Office of Strategic Communication. The team in May vetted the pitches and recommended 7 for funding. Interim UI President John Keller okayed those recommendations, and a UI-created P3 board approved them on June 1. The projects include $4 million over 2 years for a project labeled Seeding Excellence, Strengthening the University as a Destination for Research and Scholarship, led by Aaron Klein, Director of the Research Development Office, in the UI Office for Vice President of Research. That program aims to encourage UI research expansion by offering competitive pilot funding in areas across campus that will strategically advance institutional priorities. The project aims to propel opportunities for faculty collaboration and support endeavors contributing to faculty recruitment and retention, It will back interdisciplinary research grants, early faculty research, community-engaged scholarships, and diversity, equity, and inclusion funds meant to supplement opportunities from students from underfunded groups. Also, $3.6 million over 3 years for an effort to extend Iowa's success in space-based research across campus, led by Department Chair of UI Physics and Astronomy, Philip Carrett. The project aims to strengthen the institution's ability to successfully compete for NASA funding for space missions and instruments. It includes a space instrumentation summer program meant to position the UI as the destination of choice for students interested in space research. Also, $2.2 million over 3 years to establish an Iowa Health data resource led by Boyd Knops, Associate Director for Biomedical Informations Operations and Associate Dean for Information Technology, Carver College of Medicine. The project aims to improve the UI research community's access and use of health science data, considering analyzing patient data plays a central and critical role in advancing research across the broad spectrum of healthcare. The new Iowa Health Data Resource will support future health informatics research. $900,000 over 3 years goes for a campus-wide Learning at Iowa framework aimed at upping student success in the college setting, led by Physiological and Brian Sciences Chair Sean Vecera. The program will develop and implement the Learning at Iowa framework to transform the culture of learning throughout the campus, spanning a variety of academic courses, residence hall settings, and academic advising sessions, and more. $758,867 over 3 years goes for an Equity in Health Science and Practice initiative aimed at engaging a cross-section of campus and community constituents for rigorous health equity research and the translation of research findings into community-based interventions. UI Assistant Professor of Internal Medicine Martha Carvor is leading that work. $540,000 over 2 years is for a project aimed at closing the gap in experiential learning by providing more opportunities for all UI undergraduates. Experiential education provides students with opportunities to apply learning to real-world contexts while also fostering career preparation and improving job placement rates, according to details of the project, led by Pomerantz Center Executive Director Angie McKee. This project seeks to close gaps in student participation by assessing the landscape for experiential education and barriers to student participation. $113,768 over 2 years is for an initiative aiming to examine and enhance academic policies to better undergraduate student success and equity, according to UI officials. This project examines the impact of academic probation and course placement at the UI with a goal of tailoring policies and practices to promote overall student success and foster equity in student outcomes, according to UI officials. The project is expected to positively impact undergraduate student retention and graduation rates. Over the life of the P3 arrangement, the institution expects to allocate up to $735 million for initiatives. Campus community members can begin submitting proposals for next year's round of funding in the fall semester. UI spokeswoman Ann Bassett said more details are coming. And this story also on the front page today, a concert spotlights Boy's disappearance, this by Kat Russell. Sunday marked 1 month since 11-year-old Xavier Harrelson disappeared from a mobile home park in Montezuma, and authorities have kept silent about the investigation for more than 2 weeks, releasing no new information as a reward fund grows. A benefit concert is planned for 6:30 p.m. today at the Poweshiek County Fairgrounds, 425 East Street South in Grinnell. People are encouraged to wear orange, Xavier's favorite color. The concert is free, but donations are welcomed. The concert is being organized by members of Molly's Movement, Finding Others Facebook group, according to the event information and invitation. The group was started 3 years ago when rising University of Iowa sophomore Molly Tibbetts, age 20, disappeared while out for a run in Brooklyn. Her body was found about a month later in a cornfield near Guernsey. In May, a jury found Christian Bahena Rivera, age 26, guilty of her murder. The group now focuses on calling attention to other cases involving missing children. Organizers say proceeds from the concert, which includes a silent auction and concession sales, will go to a reward fund set up earlier this month at Montezuma State Bank for information leading to the discovery of Xavier's whereabouts. As of noon Monday, the fund had raised more than $25,000, a bank employee said. Local country musician Adam Whitehead will headline the event. Whitehead told the Gazette on Monday he feels a personal connection to the case and wanted to help put the search for Xavier back in the spotlight. "You know, my dad graduated from Montezuma High School, so we have a family connection to that town. And my stepson is 12 years old, almost the same age as Xavier, so I really felt the need to step up and help," Whitehead said. When event organizers reached out and asked him to play, Whitehead jumped at the chance. "It's just one of those situations where I've got this platform and I thought, you know, why not help out and raise as much awareness as possible that he's still missing," Whitehead said. "It's a sad situation," he continued. "You know, Xavier's 11 years old in a small town, and it's tough. And that country has been through much in the past few years, first with Molly Tibbetts and now this. It's like, holy cow, man." Local musician Hunter Mason also will perform at the benefit. Authorities say Xavier was last seen at the Spruce Village Trailer Park, where he lived with his mother, on the northwest edge of Montezuma. He disappeared after leaving home about 11 a.m. May 27. The mobile home park is less than a mile from Diamond Lake County Park, which features more than 660 acres of wooded land, a 90-acre lake, and roughly 120 campsites. A call Monday to the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation requesting an update on the investigation went unanswered. In the early weeks of the investigation, Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation Assistant Director Mitch Mortbelt told the Gazette that investigators had conducted dozens of searches, interviewed 100 or more people, and were running down and re-evaluating numerous tips and leads. Investigators also have done background checks on people close to Xavier and those living in the vicinity and looked into registered sex offenders in the area and those with criminal convictions. Mortbelt said that's standard procedure in any missing persons case. A digital tip line, fbi.gov/findXavier, was launched June 5 in the hopes of bringing in new leads. Mortbelt has called the boy's disappearance suspicious, but has repeatedly said there is no evidence that definitively points to whether Xavier ran away, became lost, or was abducted. Xavier was last known to be wearing a red T-shirt, blue pajama pants, and black high-top shoes. He has brown hair and blue eyes and is about 4 feet 8 inches tall and weighs 100 pounds. Anyone with information related to his disappearance should call the Poweshiek County Sheriff's Office at 641-623-2107. Moving now to the Iowa Today page, City Hall to reopen in Iowa City this week. This by Lee Hermiston. City Hall is expected to reopen to the public later this week. According to the city news release, City Hall will reopen on Thursday. It closed to the public March 18, 2020, during the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Since then, only the front lobby and police department have been open. The City Hall reopened. Residents will be able to pay bills, purchase permits, and conduct other city business in person. The Iowa City Council also is scheduled to return to in-person meetings July 6. According to the news release, face masks will be encouraged but not required in City Hall. Free masks will be available inside the building. The drop box in the front lobby for utility payments and other documents will remain in place. The drive-through utility payment drop-off on the east side of City Hall still is available, the city said. Johnson County fully reopened county facilities, including the county administration building, on June 1. The county continues to offer remote services online and over the phone and email. Drop boxes for paperwork also remain in place. And from the Today page, this story by Trish Mahaffey, prosecutors seek college records for man accused of killing family. Prosecutors, in addition to seeking access of medical records, want college transcripts for the 20-year-old Cedar Rapids man charged with fatally shooting his parents and sister 2 weeks ago. Assistant Linn County Attorney Monica Slaughter, in a motion filed Monday, asked the court for access to the University of Iowa transcripts for Alexander Ken Jackson to aid in the county attorney's investigation. The reasons for this subpoena will be explained to a judge during a hearing Wednesday, due to the confidential nature of the investigation, she said in the motion. Defense attorneys also filed a motion Monday asking the court to issue an order directing the prosecutors and the Cedar Rapids Police Department to turn over a garage door opener to the Jackson's home, where Jackson's father, Jean Perry Jackson, 61, mother Melissa Fern Jackson, 68, and his sister, Sabrina Hannah Jackson, 19, were killed on June 15. Prosecutors do not resist this motion. Last week, prosecutors filed subpoenas to access Jackson's medical records and statements he made to emergency responders and other medical staff when he was treated for a gunshot injury to his foot. 6th Judicial District Chief Judge Lars Anderson granted the subpoenas, but the defense filed a resistance, arguing the prosecution can't access those records because they are privileged medical information, according to Iowa law. Jackson, a Cedar Rapids Kennedy High School graduate and student at the UI, is charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder. He told police he awoke to the sound of gunfire and was shot in the foot as he struggled over a rifle with a masked intruder. A prosecutor during Jackson's initial appearance said Jackson concocted that story to cover up the execution of his family. Slaughter told the Gazette last week that the family members who were found in different rooms of the house were shot multiple times and died from gunshot injuries. Jackson called 911 and told a dispatcher he and his father had been shot by a male intruder, according to the criminal complaint. Cedar Rapids police officers arrived at 8:23 a.m. and found the victims. A criminal complaint stated that investigators found no evidence of forced entry or burglary at the home. Investigators found in the home a .22 caliber Browning semi-automatic rifle that police believe is the murder weapon, according to the complaint. Jackson said he and his father had left it on the fireplace after cleaning it the night before, the complaint said. Jackson remains in jail under a $3 million cash-only bail. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest column today is submitted by Glenn Gray, and the title, You and I Must Change. In response to Vanessa Miller's June 24 article in the Gazette, Iowa Student Leaders Call on Lawmakers to Ease Tuition Burden, students should not suffer additional tuition hikes. Tuition hikes at the University of Northern Iowa in particular should not be approved given UNI's ongoing decline in enrollment. UNI's current president started on February 1, 2017, when fall enrollment was 11,907 students. UNI enrollment has since declined by 20%, a drop of 2,385 students. Enrollment fell 695 students in the fall 2018, 715 students in the fall 2019, and 975 students in fall 2020. This ongoing trend indicates enrollment at UNI will likely be under 9,000 students in fall 2021. At an enterprise designed, staffed, and financed to serve over 13,000 students. Instead of raising tuition, UNI may begin to address ongoing enrollment and finance challenges by considering the following changes. Number 1. Lower tuition and fees to be more competitive with public comprehensive institutions across the Midwest, many of which are more affordable than UNI. Number 2. Create new, innovative, and effective strategies relative to enrolling, retaining, and graduating diverse and marginalized students. Number 3, right-size UNI's campus footprint. The utility savings alone may provide UNI more money than tuition increases can generate. Number four, outsource costly auxiliary services, services the local community will appreciate the opportunity to provide. That is auto pool, refuse removal, bookstore, health services, catering, and retail operations. Number five, convert UNI's Division I athletics program to Division II, or maintain the Division I athletics program but eliminate UNI's costly football program. Number six, stop costly and counterproductive turnover of faculty and staff. That is, there have been four enrollment executives at UNI over the past 8 years. And number seven, evaluate whether the leadership provided by UNI's president and vice president for finance and operations is the type of leadership needed to right the ship going forward. According to the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, the number of high school graduates is predicted to drop from approximately 3,450,000 in 2020 to approximately 3,250,000 in 2030, a drop of approximately 200,000 potential enrollees in higher education. Business as usual at UNI will not improve the enrollment and finance challenges UNI is experiencing, and increases in tuition should not be tolerated by students and taxpayers. And again, that's submitted by Glenn Gray. He is a tenured university administrator with 35 years of experience in higher education, including 19 years as chief housing officer. The guest column today is submitted by Laverne Burton, entitled Expanding Medigap is Essential. John, known as Jack Reynolds from Carlisle, Iowa, was only 4 years old when he suffered an injury resulting in lifelong kidney failure. He depended on four-hour dialysis treatments 3 days a week for the rest of his life until dying of kidney failure at age 64. Jack was fortunate to have access to secondary insurance coverage to pay for the out-of-pocket expenses for his treatment, but many in his situation are excluded from this coverage. Patients with kidney failure or end-stage renal disease, ESRD, are not guaranteed access to vital secondary medical insurance called Medigap, often leaving them in a vulnerable financial situation and in some cases preventing them from being added to the transplant list. While Congress made sure that all ESRD patients could access Medicare, they left it up to states to determine whether Medigap would be available to those under 65. Iowa is one of 19 states where kidney failure patients under 65 are excluded from access, potentially leaving 1,477 Iowans struggling to afford the treatments they need to live. More than 500,000 Americans across the country rely on dialysis, an exhausting and time-consuming treatment. Kidney failure patients are among the most vulnerable populations for severe illness from COVID-19, and they have had the highest rate of COVID-19 hospitalizations among all Medicare beneficiaries. Further, patients who are immunocompromised, including transplant patients, dialysis patients, and patients requiring immunosuppression for treatment of kidney disease, may not build the same level of immunity from the COVID-19 vaccine. Kidney care is a huge financial burden, with one out of every six patients unable to afford the cost of care and turning to the American Kidney Foundation for assistance. More than 80% of dialysis patients are unable to work. Medicare covers 80% of the cost of medical care for most Americans with ESRD, regardless of age. However, the other 20%, upward of $10,000 per year for the average dialysis patient, must be paid by a secondary type of insurance or out-of-pocket. While Medicare coverage of ESRD is a lifesaver, there is no out-of-pocket cap, and patients without secondary insurance can spiral into bankruptcy, especially those in states like Iowa that don't offer Medigap at all. When Jack Reynolds wasn't completing his many hours of dialysis, he was traveling to Washington, D.C., and advocating for better kidney care and insurance coverage. While in Washington, Reynolds met with U.S. Representative Cindy Axne, Democrat from Iowa, to share his story and push for expanded Medigap coverage. His efforts paid off. In the fall of 2020, Axne introduced the Jack Reynolds Memory Medigap Expansion Act, requiring insurers to offer Medigap to all Medicare beneficiaries. Jack Reynolds may not be here to benefit from the legislation that bears his name, but it could save the lives of more than 95,000 Americans under age 65. It is vital that Congress take action to protect all Medicare beneficiaries across the country, regardless of age and what state they live in, by enacting this important legislation. And Laverne Burton is president and CEO of the American Kidney Fund. Two letters to the editor today: preserve and protect our threatened right to vote. If the United States Senate refuses to debate the For the People Act, we do have an option to protect our vote. Go to the polls in 2022, regardless of any barrier placed in your path, and vote out of office Republican legislators and Governor Kim Reynolds. Vote while you still can to preserve and protect our democracy. This is our path to stop what really is the steal. And that's signed by Muriel Stedman from Marion. Our next letter is titled, Governor Reynolds' Border Gambit Scores Political Points. I see that Governor Kim Reynolds is sending 25 to 30 Iowa patrol officers to the Texas border for 2 weeks to protect Iowans from all the drugs, human trafficking, and violent crime caused by the increased numbers of refugees. Brilliant. Why didn't anyone think of this before? While it is not exactly clear what the troopers will be doing, I am sure Steve King will remind them to be on the lookout for anyone with calves the size of cantaloupes, though it is unlikely that this Queen's Gambit will result in any real solutions. It will at least help to bolster the governor's political profile. After all, in political advertising, the maxim points is points still reigns. That's signed by Hal Penick from Iowa City. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, June 29th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituary page. In the other notices from Andrew, John Waters, age 59, died Saturday, June 26th, Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. In Cedar Rapids, Dixie Lee Loss, age 84, died Monday, June 28, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. In Kelowna, Linda Cox, age 77, died Saturday, June 26, Yoder Powell Funeral Home, Kelowna. From Kyoto, Barbara Greiner, age 78, died Sunday, June 27, Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Kyoto. In Maquoketa, Janice Hahn, age 82, died Sunday, June 27th, Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. From Solon, Ronald D. Pettit, age 67, died Sunday, June 27th, Cedar Memorial Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. And in Waukon, Kenneth D. Lauve, age 73, died Saturday, June 26th, Martin Grau Funeral Home, Waukon. Moving now to the regular notices from Cedar Rapids, Jeff Roster, age 64, died Saturday, June 26th. Private burial will take place at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Marion, Albert, known as Al Leroy Etzel, age 95, died Sunday, June 27th, of natural causes. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, July 2, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A memorial graveside service will take place at 10 a.m. Saturday, July 3, at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion, officiated by certified celebrant Casey Hepker. Military honors will be conducted by the United States Army and the Marion American Legion Post number 298. From Marion, Louis Leonard Stolba passed away peacefully at St. Luke's Hospital June 26th at the age of 98 years, 7 months. A visitation and memorial service will be held Tuesday, July 6th at the American Legion in Marion. The visitation will begin at 1 p.m. with the service beginning at 2. From Davenport, Harold Peter Bergen, age 94, of Davenport, passed away Thursday, June 24, at his home, with his family by his side. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, June 30th, at Risen Christ Church in Davenport. Burial will be at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. Memorials in Harold's name may be made to the family. And lastly, from Waterloo, Glenn H. Jeffress, age 94, passed away in the early morning hours of Saturday, June 26th, at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home from congestive heart failure. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Cedar Valley Hospice. Memorial services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, July 2, at Kern's Funeral Service in Waterloo. Visitation is from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, June 30th, at Kern's. Interment will take place at Memorial Park Cemetery in Waterloo. Moving now to the sports page, good Trojans show up. This story by K.J. Pilcher. Iowa City West coach Charlie Stumpf compared his team to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The Trojans resembled more of a good doctor from the Robert Louis Stevenson novel last night. The Trojans played clean baseball and produced timely hits, sweeping Class 4A, fourth-ranked Cedar Rapids Prairie in a Mississippi Valley Conference baseball doubleheader at West. The Trojans scored two in the sixth for a 3-1 victory in the opener and used a 7-run fifth for a 9-3 win in Game 2. This was a time they played well against a highly ranked team and finished with victories. This was getting wins, said Stumpf, noting a 2-0 loss to number 2, Pleasant Valley. We've played some really good teams tough, and then some days we forget what we're doing out there. It's a unique group, but we've gotten a lot better from the start of the year. West improved, and the sweep could be a springboard for more consistent play, even though they face another ranked team this week. In the opener, the bottom of the West lineup produced runs. Noah Desaulniers, the number 9 hitter, hit his first home run with a solo leadoff shot in the third. The batters directly in front of him contributed in the fifth. Cade Atkins had a sacrifice fly that scored John Sayata, who was running for Marcus Morgan after being hit by a pitch to start the frame. Skylar Houston added an RBI single for the last run. Alex McKay had two hits to lead West in Game 1. We're not going to Bronx bomb anybody, Stump said. We have to piece it together, and we hope we have it. Morgan came in to pitch the seventh, retiring the Hawks in order with a strikeout for the save. The All-State right-hander and University of Iowa signee picked up where he left off, starting the nightcap. He allowed just one run and three hits in four innings, surrendering a solo home run to Maddox Freese, that broke a scoreless tie in the third. West scored two in the bottom half of the inning. The first one came on a fluke play where Ryan Vanderleest was hit in the face by the double play relay throw, sliding into second. Houston scored. Mitch Fry's sacrifice fly scored Nate Gudenkoff for a 2-1 lead. Fry came up big in the big fifth inning in the nightcap. He ripped a 2-run single after the Trojans led off the inning with two walks and hit a batsman. West took a 4-2 lead. Caden Harrison had three hits to lead Prairie, that has a record now of 23-5, 18-4. Here's a fun human interest story from the AP. In the sports section, a Yankee fan gets her chance after 60 years. Gwen Goldman finally got to be a bat girl for the New York Yankees 60 years after she was turned down because of her gender. At age 70, Goldman worked at Yankee Stadium during the game against the Los Angeles Angels last night. She had been rejected by then-general manager Roy Hamey, who wrote her in a letter on June 23, 1961, quote, "While we agree with you that girls are certainly as capable as boys, and no doubt would be an attractive addition on the playing field, I am sure you can understand that this is a game dominated by men. A young lady such as yourself would feel out of place in a dugout," end quote. Current Yankee general manager Brian Cashman said he had been forwarded an email written by Goldman's daughter, Abby. In a letter dated this June 23, he wrote, quote, "It is not too late to reward and recognize the ambition you showed in writing that letter to us as a 10-year-old girl. Some dreams take longer than they should to be realized, but a goal attained should not dim with the passage of time. I have a daughter myself, and it is my sincere hope that every little girl will be given the opportunity to follow her aspirations into the future." End quote. Wearing a full Yankees uniform, Goldman threw out a ceremonial first pitch to New York player Tyler Wade, then stood alongside manager Aaron Boone for the national anthem. "I think it's really cool," Boone said after meeting her. "I think we're going to see her probably take balls out at some point to home plate. Hopefully it's an experience of a lifetime for her and a long one in coming." Also on the front page of the sports section, this story by J.R. Ogden, fifth season races back, but still not normal. July 4 race won't have any prize money or kids events, but road racing is back. The pandemic took its toll on many major sporting events in 2020 and into 2021. High school and college athletes lost entire seasons, including championships. But in the midst of those heartbreaking and, to many, devastating cancellations, there were many smaller events that also were lost and got lost in the shuffle of a global mess. One of those is returning Sunday, one of my favorite events each summer, the fifth season races, also known as the fifth season 8K. It returns after sitting out at 2020. Many road races were held virtually last summer with people running on their own and turning in their times over a variety of distances. It was a good way to keep people active, and according to some evidence, it spurred many to get out and get moving for the first time. That's great, but actually having a road race where runners and walkers toe the line, find that extra gear at the end, and sprint to the finish is something special. So the fifth season 8K will celebrate its 36th year and 35th running on its traditional July 4 date. That's special. That's exciting. "Even though it's modified a bit, it's good to be back," said Jim Dwyer, co-president of Corridor Running and co-director of the fifth season races. "It's a little bit different feel," said Brian Tharp, the other co-president and co-director. "I wish we could go full bore, but it's nice to at least have something." That something will feel a little different, for sure. For one, the field is capped at 1,000 runners and walkers. There will be no elite division, no invited talent to race for prize money. There will be no prize money. There also will be no kids race, no post-race party or awards ceremony at Green Square, where the races will start and finish. Heck, there won't even be age group awards. "We don't feel comfortable with 1,000 people running and hanging out," Thorpe said. But there will be an 8K, the granddaddy of 8Ks in the Midwest, by the way, and a 5K. And there will be trophies for the top three men and top three women, trophies that very likely will go to local talent instead of runners chasing a check. "I think they will cherish those," Tharp said. The course will also return to its traditional out-and-back route, running up 3rd Avenue, Grand Avenue, and through Beaver Park before returning downtown. Other changes include the packet pack pickup. It will be a drive-through on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., at the city CSC building, and the start of the races will have wider staggers. The gun goes off in the 8K at 7:30 a.m. The 5K starts at 8:30. "Some of these changes could become the new normal," Dwyer said, "like the staggered start. It remains to be seen," he said. "We'll have to see how it plays out," Tharp said. Tharp said the field already was at around 700 as of Monday, and it should be really close to the 1,000 cap. He said it's a fairly even split, with maybe 60% doing the 8K. He thinks there will be a lot of first-time participants in the 5K, runners, joggers, or walkers. "You see both men also in there enjoying their running stores." Dwyer operates Iowa Running Company, and Tharp runs We Run LLC. Both have seen an uptick in runners and walkers numbers, one of the silver linings that came out of the pandemic. "We've seen a lot of new faces. It's good to see people getting out," Tharp said. "I hope it sticks," Dwyer said. "Because 2022 could bring things back to the real normal. Kids races, elite runners chasing prize money, no cap on participants, and a big party after a big race. I'm really looking forward to 2022, Dwyer said with a laugh. Moving now to the community page, here are the Eastern Iowa briefs for today. From Cedar Rapids, NCSML to raise money for tornado-struck Czech Republic. On the evening of June 24, an EF3 to EF4 tornado struck several villages in the Hodonin and Breklav districts of the South Moravian region of the Czech Republic. As the Czech and Slovak republics were some of the first to send aid to support the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library during the flood of 2008, the NCSML is asking for direct financial assistance to help the affected region in the Czech Republic. The 2021 South Moravian tornado struck several villages in the districts of the South Moravian region of the Czech Republic. An extreme storm, including a tornado and large hailstones, devastated several villages, killed at least 5 people, injured at least 200, and left more than 120,000 residents without power. It was the strongest tornado ever witnessed in the country, as its wind speed reached EF3 and EF4 levels on the Fujita scale. The tornado struck 7 municipalities, with the worst damage in the villages of Moravska, Nova Ves, Ruski, Lucis, and Nikosis. Hodonin is the birthplace of Thomas Gehrig Masaryk, where there is a Moravian region museum dedicated to the first president of Czechoslovakia. NCSML president and CEO Dr. Cecilia Rokusek said, assisting those so severely affected by the strongest and most devastating storm ever in the country is our responsibility and is essential for preserving our rich history for the long-term future from both local and transatlantic perspectives. In this new and horrific disaster, we are also reinforcing the importance of our work together to learn from history and create a strong future of sharing, innovation, peace, and ongoing collaboration. To donate funds, visit ncsml.org/support/donate. Rokusek will present the funds at a future date. From Iowa City, the public library is to further expand services starting on Thursday. On Thursday, the Iowa City Public Library will move to Phase 5A of the reopening plan to expand library hours, remove the time limits for browsing, extend time limits for computer access, and lift building and bookmobile capacity restrictions. In addition to previously available services, the study and meeting rooms will be open to the public, and ICPL outreach services and programs will be offered off-site. Masks are suggested for those not yet vaccinated. Library Director Ellsworth Carmen wants the public to be aware that while our mask requirement ends July 1, we still ask that patrons be mindful of the many library users who cannot yet be vaccinated, including children, and consider wearing a mask if not fully vaccinated. Community health is a shared responsibility, and we are so thankful for your help in keeping others safe. The library will return to pre-pandemic hours of operation starting on Thursday. The hours are Monday to Thursday, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., Friday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday, noon to 5 p.m. Computers and DOT kiosk access will be available during open hours. Public access computers will have two-hour sessions with automatic extensions enabled if at least one computer is free. If all computers are in use, then the longest extended session will be canceled. There is no advance sign-up. Remote printing will be available with pickup at the info desk. Self-service black and white is 10 cents per page and color printing is 50 cents per page. Faxing will be free and limited to 10 pages. Headphones and charging cords also are available for use. Library cardholders are invited to visit icpl.org to put items on hold. Please wait to receive notification that materials are ready before visiting the library. Items can be picked up inside the building or bookmobile. All materials remain fine-free until June 30, 2022. Some service areas of the library still will not be available including the COSA Family Teen Center, in-person indoor ICPL-led events, the Digital Media Lab, and the Book End. For more information or to call the library, call 319-356-5200. And in Coralville, the new Iowa River Trail segment by Clear Creek is now open. The Iowa City River Trail between Rocky Shore Drive and Clear Creek in Coralville is now open to the public. The trail was constructed from Rocky Shore Drive to Clear Creek. This project included two prefabricated steel truss bridges over Clear Creek and a 10-foot-wide concrete trail from Rocky Shore Drive to connect it to the Iowa River Trail on the north side of Clear Creek. Trail users are asked to stay on the pavement until vegetation is established within the project corridor. An opening ceremony is planned for a later date. And also on the community page, this story by Caleb McCullough, creating a gathering place. Weatherby Park gets a new playground, larger pavilion, and a bike repair station. A new playground, shelter, and bike repair stations have joined the amenities offered at Weatherby Park in Iowa City, and community members said the improvements help strengthen the neighborhood and build community. Part of an ongoing project to improve the city's parks, Weatherby recently underwent construction to install a larger pavilion and separate restroom and replace the playground equipment. The city also installed a bike repair station at the park in early June, which allows cyclists to fill their tires and make minor repairs to their bikes on the go. Megan Alter, a member of the South District Neighborhood Association and a candidate in the Iowa City Council November election, said the improvements have helped make the park stand out as a destination in Iowa City. While the bulk of the structure renovations were completed last fall, Parks and Rec Director Julie Seidel Johnson said final touches like plumbing to the restroom and community gardens weren't finished until early June. The expanded pavilion allows for larger groups to meet at the park, and Alter said the new structure will allow activities for all ages. All around, they did a really, really good job, and it needed it, she said. Even though they did it through a lot of difficulties, it has really come out well. Alter said the bike repair station will help people make good use of the trails around the park. The repair station, one of several peppered around city parks, was funded with a Program for Improving Neighborhoods grant to the South District Neighborhood Association. The grants are given by the city to neighborhood associations to beautify and improve Iowa City's neighborhoods. Alter said Weatherby Park often is a meeting place for kids and adults alike to go on bike rides through Sycamore Trailways or to Terry Trueblood, and having the repair station makes the area more bike-friendly. The Neighborhood Association also has worked with the Bike Library and other groups to organize leisure rides around the South District. Those groups have been very vocal about advocating for making it more bike-friendly. This is a huge step in that direction, Alter said. Alter said the improvements in Weatherby Park help build the community of the South District and improve its image in the community. We have an incredibly tight-knit and proud community, she said. The work that we've done as neighbors has helped build up the South District in important ways and in ways that make us really happy to live here. Seidel Johnson said resilient and beautiful parks enhance the neighborhoods they reside in. My goal is to get people out of their houses at night, getting to know their neighbors so they have a real sense of community, and having quality parks throughout the community does this, she said. And that does it for the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette. You've been listening to Iris. You can access the reading of today's paper on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day.